From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 14th installment in a discussion with Professor Luciana Bone about the political economy of the USSR, and we've been focusing on the response to the creation of the USSR and its rise, with the response from the West being, in many cases, fascism. Welcome back.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be back.
So
we are continuing our gallop through the dark landscape of European fascism between the two world wars. And today, as you noted, we focus on Austrofascism. Actually, this is the second examination of fascism after Italian. We still have Portuguese and Spanish to go of the major ones. But anyway, today, Austrofascism. But I would like to emphasize or warn that my interpretation of fascism is and has been Marxist. And I would also add that it is classically Marxist, meaning 1930s Marxist. I think it's important to know the political stance of the source, because I find it dishonest for analysts to occult their political stance. Viewers should be able to judge from that.
Right.
So, the Marxist theories of fascism see fascism as a form of reaction to socialism and also a feature of capitalism. Particularly, as you noted in the introduction, the socialism, communism of the USSR. There are other interpretations, classic interpretations, just three. The main historians, or the early historians of fascism, of course, happened in Italy, and one of them was the liberal Benedetto Croce, and he saw that, he argued that fascism was the consequence of the crisis, of the moral crisis of European society of the first half of the 19th century. Another classic interpretation is that fascism is a inevitable result of delayed processes of development in some countries. We're not talking about, we're not going into those at this point.
Right.
We're going into the, or I apply the third classic, as I call it, Marxist interpretation, which is that fascism occurs in the stage of kind of declining capitalism and as a product of extreme class struggle, or as a answer to extreme class struggle. Okay?
So what we would say then, the three of them, just to give like a quick analysis of each, one is almost religious, it's moral. The next is a political critique within the confines of the capitalist viewpoint. In other words, the prevailing viewpoint of the period, the liberal viewpoint of the period. In other words, the political development of places like Germany and Italy, which didn't become European nation states on the order of, say, Britain or France until 50, 60, 70 years later, that stunted development is what produced fascism there, a sort of a misshapen capitalism. And then finally, the Marxist one, which is a class analysis.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there are not three, there are really two, the liberal and the Marxist. The liberal is interclassist. That's a word that is used. It just doesn't use class analysis. And just as you said, and the Marxist is a class analysis. So really, there are only two. And there are, and you know, in the liberal one, there are all sorts of varieties. But there is one form that I consider absolutely wrong and possibly perverse interpretation of fascism. I just choose Friedrich von Hayek interpretation, and that fascism is a totalitarian and nationalist socialism.
Right.
No.
Well, you're looking at a socialism that, again, is devoid of any class content, because socialism at the base means control and or ownership of the means of production by the workers, and that is not part of any fascist program. They may have a magical representation of it, a symbolic representation of it, in that, well, the Volk are the class, you know, no matter what class they belong to, and as long as someone that belongs to this Volk that I'm a part of is in control, then I'm in control, which of course is sort of the same as the slave talking about our house regarding the plantation house.
Exactly. But, you know, this form, which was popularized in the 1930s by liberals, social democrats, Marxist communists, this form was popularized in opposition to Stalin.
Right.
To Stalin's plans, and to, you know. So, and it is peculiarly, I wouldn't say peculiarly, because we live in a reactionary age, it is very popular today. That is, that socialism and fascism are the same, are equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
This is enshrined in the European celebration of the day that denounces totalitarian regimes such as communism and fascism. In other words, today, this is the accepted form of the analysis of fascism, that it's nothing other than communism.
Mm-mm. You know, if you want to look at the most perverse, I won't say the most, but one contemporaneous perversion along those lines, it's represented in some of the signs that people carried at the inauguration in Washington in January, with Trump's name having a hammer and sickle in it, and in the assertion by some that Trump is actually a Marxist. They conflate Marxism, communism, at Russia, altogether, and make Trump, of course, Putin's stooge, which makes him a Marxist, so by this quote-unquote analysis.
I'm sorry, but it's like a comedy act. Go ahead, Don.
No, it is. No, that's all. I just wanted to say that, you know, this confusion is alive and well today.
Yes, yes.
Or alive, anyway. I don't know how. It's not well. It's pretty sick, actually.
Yes, it is. I think it's also funny that Obama was called a socialist.
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly. If only.
So, you know, you had in 1939, September, that is the break out of the Second World War, you had a New York Times editorial that said, Hitlerism is brown communism, Stalinism is red fascism. Benito Mussolini positively reviewed Stalinism. He was in favor of it.
Right.
because apparently Stalin had transformed Soviet Bolshevism into a Slavic fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Thomas, what was he leader of? Socialist Party of United States?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
Well, he said, such is the law in 1940. Such is the logic of totalitarianism, that funny word, that communism, whatever it was originally, is today red fascism.
Mm-mm-mm.
Bruno Rizzi, who founded the Italian Communist Party in 1921, whenever, said in 1938, Stalinism took on a regressive course, generating a species of red fascism identical in its superstructural and choreographic, he's an Italian, so he uses big words, features with its fascist model. Who else? Then I'll just move on to Austrofascism. Otto Ruhle, founder of the German left communist party with Liebknecht, a communist, wrote that, quote, the struggle against fascism must begin with the struggle against Bolshevism.
Yeah, this is the whole, this is the real purpose of it, by the way. The, yeah. You know, the specter that Marx wrote about in 1848 that yeah. haunted Europe and the world in 1917 et sec was the specter of actual socialism, and the only threat of that in the world, however perfect or imperfect, was based in Moscow and among the working classes of the world, with Moscow being the match and the work, you know, the working conditions of the working class being gasoline poured over the planet. So they were scared to death of the Soviet Union, and neutralizing the Soviet Union as a possible source of support for working class uprisings was job one, and they pulled out all the stops from left to right, and that's why you have this kind of consensus.
Left to right, sorry.
And we see it today. I was looking at you. I don't know if you've seen perusing critiques of the Communist Party Congress in China from the so-called left, but they're comparing Xi to Hitler. That the new China, that socialism with Chinese characteristics is actually national socialism. This is something that someone published. Actually, I think I saw it in Breitbart yesterday, but it was not by Bannon or anyone there who's a, whether you disagree with them or not, a serious thinker and or critic, but someone else who's clearly not, if you read the piece. But this is also, a lot of people on the left are spewing that on Facebook today as well.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to run through those, but in Italian, I haven't had a chance to read them carefully, but it is an avalanche of absurdities.
Yeah.
It's personalizing the history of, well, the 100-year history, practically, of the Chinese Communist Party into
That's
this
right.
new Stalin, new Hitler.
Right.
That is Xi,
yeah.
you know, it's the same thing. So
yeah.
so we're seeing, as you noted, what used to be this the fear of Moscow, now it's the fear of Beijing.
Yep.
It's manifesting itself, which means it's real.
Yep, that's right. They see it as a threat because it is. but
because
not for,
it is,
But
yeah.
not for the reasons
so
that they
Rulle say. Is interesting to examine because well, in addition, he said, Russia was the example for fascism, and he means Stalin's Russia. Whether party communists like it or not, the fact remains that the state order and rule in Russia are indistinguishable from those in Italy and Germany. Essentially, they are alike. One may speak of a red, black, or brown Soviet state as well as of a red, black, or brown fascism. And who was Rulle eventually? He was a member of the Dewey Commission in the United States, chaired by the philosopher, which cleared Trotsky of all charges made against him during the Moscow trials.
Well,
nice link.
Yes,
huh?
Yeah, it works out very handily, doesn't it? All right, let's go right to the Austro the fascist
I'm going
thing.
Now.
Okay, very good.
With
yeah.
The,
yep.
With the preliminary.
Yes, very good. Okay.
Okay. So I'm continuing to exemplify my thesis, which is not mine, that fascism is a reaction to socialist mass agitation, and we look at Austria. Okay, so we said that though all fascism that followed in the wake of the failed revolution of 1917-24, and again between 1931 and 1936 in Austria and later Portugal, well, not later, simultaneously, Portugal and Spain were anti-communist, but they didn't share some of the features of Italian fascism, and that this was because of their different historical genesis. So, was there fascism in Austria between 1917 and 1937? Yes. It was called Austrofascism. Was socialism a threat to the existing order or to the liberal order, the whatever you want to call it? Yes. It was called Red Vienna. Now, Austrofascism was officially instituted in 1934 after a brief civil war in February, and Austrofascism ended in 1938 with the annexation of Austria to Germany, the infamous Anschluss. The head of Austrofascism was Engelbert Dollfuss, a member of the Christian Social Party. It suppressed Red Vienna and ended social democracy and democracy in general. It was a nationalist Catholic dictatorship. However, let's proceed historically. So that's just a, you know, basic map. So what was wrong in Austria that Austro-fascism took over? Well, Austria in the 20th century lost its European empire with defeat in World War I. So there was a Republic of German Austria proclaimed, on November 12, 1918.
Right.
Now, the two major factions that dominated the politics in this new republic were the socialists in the Socialist Democratic Workers' Party and the conservatives, which I call reactionary, represented by the Christian Social Party, the two. The socialists found their stronghold in the working class districts of the cities, naturally,
right,
while the conservatives were mostly in the among the rural population and the upper classes, the fading aristocracy of the Habsburg Empire.
Right.
The conservatives also maintain a close alliance with the Roman Catholic Church and could count among their ranks very leading clerics. So from 1920 onwards, all chancellors of the Republic of Austria, which that first republic lasted until 1945, were members of the Christian Socialist Party. So what was it? It was founded in 1891. It identified Austrian as sharing a Catholic religious identity. This will resurface in Spain among the Franquistas, and as opposed to the Protestant identity of the Prussians, the largest state in Germany. So from 1920 onwards, sorry, I lost my place on the outline.
Yep, yeah.
So we have the Christian Social Party of Austria, and we have the Social Democrats,
right,
who remained in opposition from 1920 on, and they concentrate on the Red Vienna stronghold.
Yeah. Let me just interject here. For the period from 1918 to 1920, you have Red Vienna, governing at that point in time. Immediately, they have universal suffrage, an 8-hour workday, the unemployment insurance, all these things that these are the first time outside of the USSR that these things were implemented anywhere, and some of them happened within a week of November 12th, 1918. In 1920, the coalition that put the Social Democrats in the driver's seat broke down. The Christian Democrats take power, and now you have an entirely different condition until the end of World War II. That's
Well, something that, as we look to the details, we go through the details, we will notice that the notion today also proposed that the fascism is ushered into power by a surge of populist enthusiasm is wrong.
Right.
It was wrong in Italy. It will be wrong in Austria, as we shall see.
Right.
Yeah. So, Red Vienna, where was I? So from so the Social Democrats remained in opposition and concentrated in Red Vienna, but let me explain further what was Red Vienna, as you pointed out. It's something that happened immediately after the falling apart of the Habsburg Empire with its defeat in 1918.
Right.
It was the nickname of the capital of Austria between 1918 and 1934.
Right.
When the Social Democrats had the majorities and the city was democratically governed for the first time.
That's right.
More on this later, you see.
And it was ended, by the way, with the police taking Mayor Karl Seitz out of City Hall, like, you know, more or less at gunpoint. That's how it ended.
Yeah. Yeah, during the 1934 February Civil War.
Yes.
Now, but let's go back to the Christian Social Party, which is really in power today in Austria. But we won't have time to go into that because I have all these details that I am fascinated by. So this Christian Social Party, which was founded in 1893, carried a lot of anti-secular clerical baggage in that Catholic Austria had been an internal European empire ruling Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe for centuries. In the Middle Ages, for example, and before the French Revolution of 1789, it had been called the Holy Roman Empire.
That's right.
It had not embraced the Protestant Revolution, and this put it at odds with Germany. Its claim to glory, historical glory, as all fascism always go back to some moment of glory of in the nation, in the Catholic nation in this case, was saving Christian Europe from the Ottoman Turks in the 16th century.
Mm.
Do we eat croissant for breakfast today?
Yeah, not yet, but I will very shortly, actually.
Okay, so well, that's a and that's a pastry made during the Ottoman siege of Vienna. I don't remember whether it was made in Vienna or by the Turks, but I think it was in Vienna mocking the half moon.
Ah.
Yeah, so that's a croissant.
A croissant, yes.
Okay. Now, in 1789, that was the blow that hit Catholic authority, both in Rome. And Austria became a bastion of Catholic resistance to secularization of society. You know, that's why we have this clerical present in Austria, which has this core of defender of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a position of secularization of society. And you know, all of monarchist, absolutist, reactionary Europe reacted to the French Revolution in the same way that bourgeois Europe later reacted to the Russian Revolution with invasion, aggression, and war.
Yep.
Yeah. So Austria, why did it cling to this Catholic past, this idealized, you know, past? Well, it lost Hungary, parts of Italy, and the Balkans. Its former imperial national identity shrank to a landlocked state. Trieste was its main port on the Adriatic, and it had only two remaining common features, Catholicism and anti-German, anti-Protestant nationalism. Mm. Of course, there was a pro-German, but we'll talk about that later.
Right.
And you know, and a refusal to be absorbed in the German state, which was born in 1871. But in addition, there were economic conditions that are favorable to fascism, negative condition. Austria lost its industrial centers, which had been located in places that became part of Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, and Italy, specifically the crucial port of Trieste, as I mentioned. It had become economically crippled. The middle classes who had bought war bonds now had worthless stuff in their hands, and they were plunged into poverty and hyperinflation. So new borders between Austria and the nearby region what Austria had lost in their regions that they had controlled. These regions, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, had fed Vienna for centuries, and this loss made food supply difficult.
Yeah.
Apartments were overcrowded. Diseases such as tuberculosis were rampant. The Spanish flu was, in 1918 in this case, was rampaging, and syphilis raged. So this is what was destabilizing the idea of what is Austria for Austrian nationalists. But there was another identity, and this is the one that excites us. There was an opposition claim to Austrian identity, and this was Red Vienna. Please jump in whenever you want to, I'm going on too fast.
No, this is good. I did want to note that... the fact that Catholicism held on, sort of beyond the Reformation in Austria, while Germany was more or less one of the centers of the Protestant Reformation or Protestantism, it is interesting, yes. Particularly in the context of what you outlined at the beginning, that you have perhaps these three different, critiques, the first one being a moral / religious one, that the moral slide of Europe is what produced fascism. Well, that moral slide in the eyes of the people that made that claim was the loss of Catholicism and papacy, basically, and
yes.
Going towards materialism rather than the spiritual leadership of the Catholic Church.
So and fascism is imbued with mysticism.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I posted that recently on Facebook. I posted the Wilhelm Reich interpretation because, it was 1932 that Wilhelm Reich said that fascism, in psychological term, aside from his sexual interpretation, was also kind of a mirror image of religious mysticism.
Yeah.
What used to be masochism of suffering became its obverse, sadism and homicide.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to quote that. It would take time.
Well, no, there is, and we're almost out of time. We've got about a minute and a half left. But I'll sort of encapsulate that idea with, this was, sort of spread around the West after World War II, or during World War II. But in Germany, to serve Hitler is to serve Germany. To serve Germany is to serve God. That's about as mystical as it gets, isn't it?
Yeah, eventually. If we don't have time, I just want to make sure that I do not change the program, the agenda for today, and continue with the emphasis on Red Vienna, because
Absolutely.
That's where we see that Austrofascism, in addition to looking for the psychological interpretation, looking for an identity, was also really a materialist response to Red Vienna, to the
Absolutely.
Potential that Red Vienna lasted from 1918 to 1934.
Absolutely. And under a condition of great oppression, wherever it could be mustered up, which found fullest expression in 1934. Yeah, we will definitely pick it up right here next week. I think it has some ramifications for analysis of the things going on today, as a matter of fact. So we'll pick it up here, and thank you very much again, Luciana.
Oh, thank you, Don. Pleasure, and thank you to your listeners.
Yes, thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.